This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thanks for listening to the Evening Edition. So if you're anything like me, you don't just love watching movies, you also love listening to two complete strangers jabber on about movies. You know, dissecting those themes, comparing and contrasting, digging deep, getting all meta, showing off their deep and profound knowledge of cinema. Which is why you need to check out the all-new At The Movies podcast with my buddy Umapagan Ampige Pagan. I really think he loves talking about movies more than he does watching them. And to listen, just log on to bfm.my/movies. You're listening to VoiceBox, the show that takes a look at the power and pervasiveness of the human voice in shaping our everyday world. I'm your host, Ezra Zayed. Throughout this series, we'll examine the impact of this uniquely human instrument and the role it plays in making and breaking the bonds between us. If you dial the clock back a couple of decades or so, and in fact this might apply to some of our listeners, this idea of picking up a phone call and knowing exactly who is on the other line, that's a rather, you know, recent idea. Once caller ID was introduced, you know, when the name and number pops up on your screen, you could anticipate the voice you're about to hear from. But prior to that, you really had to, in one way, identify their voice. I dragged Uma, he's the fellow host of the Evening Edition, into the studio for a quick trip down memory lane about this. So do you remember the time back in the 90s when you would get a phone call on the landline?
Okay.
And as you were about to pick it up, you genuinely had no idea who was on the other side of the call because there was no caller ID.
Oh, it was a thrill.
Yeah.
It was exciting. Every phone call was a surprise. Every call was a mystery, was a surprise, was a potential party going to happen. Remember that time when you started, you know, you reached that age, your teenage years, you're giving your phone number out to girls, you don't know when they're going to call, you don't know if they're going to call, you rush to answer every call.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your parents might pick up the phone, or your grandma might pick up
the phone.
You
don't want that.
And then she'd be like, oh, who's the girl that's calling you? Aren't you too young for girlfriends?
But also, it could be such an anticlimax because it might just be
An aunt. Yeah.
Or like a salesman trying to sell you some sort of new bottled water.
Exactly. The worst thing is when you're expecting a call.
Yes.
And then it ends up being that uncle. But then you need to get that uncle off the phone because there is no call waiting either.
Yes.
So it's not, you're just stuck.
There is this moment of about 1.5 to 2 seconds when they say, hello, this is... And you're trying to actually decipher who it is. And that's a weird thing that we just don't do anymore now.
Well, we do to a certain extent.
I mean, if it's an unknown number or if it's customer service.
And you answer the phone and it's someone you're supposed to know, someone's number you still haven't saved, that instinct in your brain still happens.
Yeah.
For a few seconds because that person says hello with a sense of familiarity. And they're like, hey, Uma.
But so there's still an element of voice recognition that goes through your head, right?
Of course.
But it's of a different variety now than what it used to be.
It could be. And then also because we're Asians, boy, do you know who this is, boy?
Oh my God.
And then you're like, yes, auntie, of course I know who this is. Then tell me who is it. And that used to get me into trouble all the time.
Yeah. All right. In this episode, we look at the art of recognizing voices.
I believe that there's two types of voices in the world. I think everybody could be put into two categories.
That's our guest tonight.
My name is Ed Primo, and I'm an audio-video forensic expert.
So what would you say are these two categories of voices in which you feel people generally fall into?
Somebody who has a common voice is somebody who sounds like a whole bunch of people, and it's almost impossible to do a voice identification test on them. African Americans here in this country, male 20 to 30 year old African Americans, have a style of speaking and an idiolect that is common among that group, and it's harder to identify that voice. Somebody who's got a very unique voice, and I'm going to use a couple of examples here. Somebody like Martin Luther King has a very unique voice.
Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today.
somebody like John Wayne has a very unique voice. Somebody like John Lennon has a very unique voice.
I didn't mean to hurt you. I'm sorry that I made you cry. Oh, no, I didn't want to hurt you. I'm just a jealous guy. Watch out.
When you get into categories like that, it's almost impossible in my world not to be able to identify that voice. In other words, if I've got a good exemplar, which is a known sample of a person's voice, I can use that exemplar to compare it to the unknown and either make an identification or not make an identification. And there's several levels of identification. There's a probable identification, there's a possible identification, possible elimination, and then, of course, positive identification and positive elimination. So it's a process that I believe can be done more effectively with a unique voice, and it's almost impossible to do with somebody who has a common voice.
Ed, with those three examples that you just mentioned, and let me try and make sense of this, are those voices unique because of the familiarity of these, you know, larger-than-life personalities, and also how frequently we're exposed to it? Is that why they're considered unique, or is there a very a distinct characteristic about John Lennon's voice or that of Martin Luther King Jr. that warrants it to be categorized as a unique voice rather than, I guess, what you would define as a common voice?
That's an excellent question. And the way I would answer that would be, because we've become so familiar and so used to hearing Martin Luther King's voice or John Lennon or John F. Kennedy or whoever, the reason you're so familiar with her voice is because you've listened to it a whole bunch of times. You've heard it over and over and over again, just like you have some of the voices that I'm referring to being unique sounding voices. But when you get into a situation where a voice identification must be performed, even if it's a common voice, the voice identification expert has got to listen to that voice over and over and over in order to become familiar with it. So familiarity is a very important part of the process of voice identification. And that's where, through experience, you take notes of the idiolect of the voice, which is a person's individual speech pattern. You listen to how they pace their words. Sometimes people pause, and it's a subconscious way of delivering dialogue.
Did you think I'd forgotten you? Perhaps you hoped I had. Every kitten grows up to be a cat. They seem so harmless at first, small, quiet, lapping up their saucer of milk. But once their claws get long enough, they draw blood, sometimes from the hand that feeds them. For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. There is but one rule: hunt or be hunted. Welcome back.
Sometimes people talk real fast and they group their words together and they always accentuate on certain portions of what they're saying.
Left-handed?
I'm amazed you didn't notice. All you have to do is look around this flat. Coffee table on the left-hand side, coffee mug handle pointing to the left. Power sockets, habitually use the ones on the left. Pen and paper on the left-hand side of the phone because he picked it up with his right and took down messages with his left. You want me to go on?
No, I think you've covered it.
I might as well. I'm almost at the bottom of the list. There's a knife on the breadboard with butter on the right.
Those type of consistencies are subconscious. So anybody who's trying to disguise their voice, they're going to have these same types of things subconsciously. And those are the types of things that help me determine whether or not it's the same person. And they're, the two examples I just gave you while I was explaining are pretty basic, just to make my point.
You're listening to a new series called Voice Box. I'm speaking to Ed Primo, an audio forensic analyst. After this, we find out exactly how does someone get into this line of work. Stay tuned to the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
I'm Ezra Zayed. You're still listening to Voice Box, the show that examines the impact of this uniquely human instrument and the role it plays in making and breaking the bonds between us. We're speaking to Ed Primo. He's an audio forensic analyst. And, you know, it's one of those professions where it sounds amazing and cool when people ask you what you do. But you're left wondering, which course did you take at university to land this job? Well, in fact, he was attending university at the time and also working as an audio engineer. And then
one day the FBI came in and they had some confidential informant recordings that needed to have the background noise removed so the conversation could be better heard.
And in the course of his work as an audio engineer, he did a lot of work for radio commercials.
Like, we used to do automotive commercials. We would do pizza commercials. We would do retail commercials, retail stores.
And in these types of commercials, you know, those big franchises or retail stores that would have multiple locations. So at the end of the commercial, the voice talent standing in the studio would say something like,
come see Jacob Jewelers at 123 North Main Street in Brooklyn. But then the other tag would be, come see Jacob Jewelers at 1256 North Main in Okasawa.
Ed, as an engineer, would have to put all of these different tags at the end of these commercials.
So I would have to move the tape reel by hand while picturing and visioning these words in my mind and use a grease pencil and a razor blade to cut the tag on so it sounded seamless.
And that's when it dawns on him.
So while I'm doing this work for the FBI and I'm making these radio commercials, I'm starting to realize there's a correlation between matching voices, listening to voices, knowing where to edit. This is back in the day where there were reel-to-reel tape.
And in cutting and pasting these tags on tape, that's when he starts to realize and distinguish the nuances of people's voices. How would voice talent A sound different when compared to voice talent B?
And I recognized voices based on their familiarity. So the further I got along working with the FBI doing these enhancements, and they did come in quite a few times, I got another case. And all of a sudden, this market began. And this was probably around 1979.
But it wasn't just about recognizing voices. Ed then figured out and acknowledged that there was a demand for services that involved voice identification, voice print analysis, audio enhancements, and video production.
I was starting to recognize that there was a forensic industry. So the further along that I went, the more cases that were referred to me. Lawyers started calling, audio started to enter the courtroom, and then police got dash cams. So now I'm asked to look at video, and I'm asked to do a voice identification on a third-party verification call recording. And every time you testify and do a case, you learn. And part of what justifies me as expert status here in this country when I'm going into testifying court and they have to establish my credibility as a scientist before I'm allowed to express my opinions, I'm often asked questions about my experience. And one of the things that qualifies me as an expert, beside the writings I've done, beside the lectures I've done, beside the cases I've testified in, is my day-to-day successfully completing cases. Being able to understand the process from A to Z and follow a protocol.
And just on that note, there are various approaches that different analysts subscribe to. Ed has his own preferences.
My voice identification process, which is not unique to me, it's the one that I practice, which is referred to as a traditional voice identification. They now have biometrics, which I have tried on several occasions, and I have one of my peers who relies heavily on voice biometrics, and I'm still not convinced. And here's one of the reasons why, right off the top of my head. I did a voice identification, I believe it was earlier this year on Paul McCartney. There was a professor at a university in Austin, Texas, who hired me to do a voice identification because he wanted to bust the myth that Paul McCartney is dead. And there's a whole thing on the internet about when they were recording Sergeant Pepper, Paul McCartney got into a car accident and was killed, so they got a lookalike who was his stand-in for the rest of the years that the Beatles were together because they didn't want to ruin a good thing. At least that's the theory.
Yeah. Okay, let me interrupt here real quick. This conspiracy theory, the Paul is dead theory, it's a big one. If you want to throw away a whole day of going down this rabbit hole, this one would probably be the one to focus on. It was certainly enough to warrant a question to Paul McCartney himself from former late-night host David Letterman.
In the toward the end of the 60s, is that when the rumors about you being dead surfaced? Do you remember that? Do you remember how that started? What were your feelings about that?
What happened? Yeah, my funeral. What happened was we did a cover for a record called Abbey Road, and the idea was to walk across the crossing, and I showed up that day with sandals, flip-flops, and so it was so hot, and I kicked them off and walked across barefooted. So this started some rumour that because he was barefooted, he's dead. I couldn't see the connection myself.
No, I don't. It seemed like a long, slow, difficult death. Being barefooted will kill you.
Scorched feet.
And what do you? How do you manage something like that? Because it was a global rumor. And
yeah. I mean, you know, I just laughed at it and knew it was just because of the fame and the craziness. It was an American DJ, so you guys are to blame.
Yeah.
Not you personally, but... No, the thing is, you know, I just laughed it off, but it was a little bit strange because people did start looking at me like...
Right.
Is it him or a very good double?
Well, that was the idea. That was the other part of it, that there was a guy who looked like you taking your place.
No, oh, well, this is him.
Yeah. Or is it?
Okay, now back to our guest, Ed Primo. He's about to take on this task of scientifically settling this debate once and for all.
So this man hired me to do this voice identification, and I was able to go in and prove scientifically that the voice before the alleged accident and the voice after the alleged accident are the same man. It's Paul McCartney. So we did this huge report that he released to the media. Nobody wanted to pick up the story because it's really not newsworthy. And we kind of talked about that going into it. But there's a very recognizable voice. And I had fun with it because, number one, I'm a Beatles fan and I love Paul McCartney. But number two, he's got an incredible, unique voice. It's so unique, nobody can imitate it. Even the imitators that are out there being Paul McCartney tribute artists don't come close to the God gift that he's been given. And it's his larynx, it's his throat, it's his tongue, it's his teeth. All of those things are what make up somebody's voice or their manner of speaking. And all of those components create the unique voice that is much easier to identify than the non-unique voice.
Ed, I'm curious now, in using the metrics and processes that you felt were suitable for this task, what did the percentage show when it came to identifying Paul McCartney?
I came up with 100%, which is very rare, because I had 10 very solid identifiers that I attributed 10% to each. And that's an in-house process, and I'm often asked, how did I arrive at that 75%? Well, I had 8 reasons why I believe those voices match. Very scientific, objective matches, not subjective, but anybody would listen to this and this and agree, yeah, that's the same sound. If I have 8 of them, but number 8 is weak, then I come up with 75%. I give them each 10%, but the eighth one I gave 5% to because it was weak. But in the Paul McCartney case, I had 10. I could have kept going. And because they're not identical, and when you make an exemplar, if somebody says, okay, I'm going to cooperate and I'm going to give you an exact exemplar, and this is an important process here, we record the exact exemplar from the suspect or the person who's accused of making the recording using the exact words spoken. So we make a transcript and we record it using as much of the exact same electronics as possible. And that removes a margin of error. In other words, we can't compare a telephone recording to a face-to-face recording made on an Olympus digital recorder with scientific certainty. And that's what it really boils down to. How scientifically certain am I that these voices match? And that's where the courts come in and say, but wait a minute, a lot of that is objective. It's not subjective. It's his own opinion that is the reason why these voices are the same. It's not something everybody could agree on. And that's that's partially true. And that's part of the reason why voice identification is considered, at least by the FBI, as a secondary investigative tool as opposed to a primary. But yet, it's not the main business activity I do, but it's a large business activity. There's still a need for voice identification. And for that reason, I believe it's going to morph into a more accepted process than it is right now.
Don't go anywhere. We'll hear more from Ed Primo, audio and video forensic expert, right after this. In fact, we'll find out what happens when voice recognition is being used as evidence in a court of law. All this on VoiceBox. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Hey, I hope you're really enjoying this podcast. Well, you must be. You've made it this far. Anyway, when you're done listening to this one, don't forget to check out At the Movies with my buddy Umapagan Ampike Pagan. It'll satisfy all your movie podcast cravings, but only after you're done listening to this one. Remember, it's bfm.my/movies. You're still tuned in to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed, and this is VoiceBox, the show that takes a look at the power and pervasiveness of the human voice in shaping our everyday world. We've been speaking to Ed Primo, an audio forensic expert. He published a book called That's Not My Voice, A Practical Understanding of the Art and Science of Modern Voice Identification. And thus far, we've learned a thing or two about how it all works. So I asked Ed, how exactly does voice recognition play out in terms of it being perceived or accepted by the public at large, but also what role it plays in a court of law?
In court, it's being perceived differently than it is in the general population, because a lot of times the cases that I work on don't enter the courtroom. However, I have two cases right now that are in motion that are both going to be in the courtroom, and I've performed voice identification testing using my experience and the process that I use. And I think by the time I finish those cases, I can answer that question a little bit better. But as of right now, the courts are very reluctant for a couple reasons. Number one, scientists don't always agree on the results. And in order for an expert to testify in court, they have got to be using scientific processes that can be replicated or duplicated by another scientist that gets the same results no matter how many times they do those tests. So voice identification isn't that dependable to where another person's going to arrive at the exact same findings as I'm going to, which is why the courts are a little reluctant. And secondly, they're a little reluctant because they don't always understand it. A judge may be convinced pretty easily based on case law in their jurisdiction, especially federal court, and argument by the opposing attorneys. So if the opposing attorney says, Your Honor, we've had four cases come through this federal court jurisdiction that have all been unreliable with voice identification, which translates to somebody has kind of spoiled that jurisdiction before I was able to get there and explain to them the signs that I'm using. And you get to the point where you're only allowed to testify on a small percentage of what you were originally going to testify on because the judge says, you can't talk about that, you can't talk about that. And that happens all the time when you testify. The judge will say, okay, I'm going to let Mr. Primo testify about A, B, and C, but not D, E, and F. And in voice identification, I'm going to have Mr. Primo explain his processes, and we'll play the recordings for the jury. But we're not going to let him go through all of the things that he believes are justifications for his conclusion. We're just going to have him play the recording, and that's better than them saying, "No, you're not allowed to testify. We're not going to accept it." So it's all over the place with where courts are currently. And one of my goals, hopefully before I leave the planet, is to give more credibility, which is why I wrote the book about voice identification testing, because I believe it is a good tool, especially in this world we live in, to where people are calling and threatening people on a regular basis. And people are upset and they want to know whose voice that was. And sometimes they recognize it. And it's not enough. Just from two litigators going into court, one of them says, I recognize that voice is not enough for the court to accept that as testimony to help sway a jury.
Right. And just curious, going back to this scientific process of of ensuring that another scientist can replicate those same results. And so are you suggesting that... Okay, let's say a suspected murderer, he leaves a message on voicemail, and I'm not sure why he would, but, you know, we have his voice on tape, and this voice recording was given to two separate forensic experts. Are you saying that with whatever other material they would be comparing it to, that these two experts would come up with two different sets of results?
They might come up with two different sets of opinions, but more than likely, if they're both credible, they will arrive at the same conclusion. And it's the route that they arrived at their conclusion is different that makes the court less trusting in the process. Let me give you an example of that. There was a very high-profile case here in the United States. Gosh, I think it's been a couple years now, where a neighborhood watchman by the name of George Zimmerman shot Hispanic, shot a young black man walking back from 7-Eleven with a hoodie on because he was suspicious that he was a troublemaker in the neighborhood. And I'm paraphrasing big time.
February 26, 2012, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin buys some Skittles and a bottle of iced tea, walks through a gated community of townhomes where he's staying with his father. That's when he catches the attention of neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman.
They always get away.
That's Zimmerman's first impression watching Trayvon Martin walking alone.
This guy looks like he's up to no good or he's on drugs or something.
Less than a minute later, Zimmerman gets out of his car.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
But then, just a few minutes later, there's another call.
911, do you need police, fire, medical?
Maybe both, I'm not sure. There's just someone screaming outside.
In the background, listen for the sound of a fight and a panicked voice yelling for help.
And is it a male or a female?
It sounds like a male.
And you don't know why?
I don't know why. I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. Just send someone quick. Say, stop.
10 seconds later, the shrieking continues. Then, a gunshot.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your...
There's gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
How many?
Just one.
Just one. A shot to the heart, ending the life of Trayvon Martin.
The prosecution asked one of my peers, Tom Owen, to do a voice identification test, while they asked me to do a voice identification test. Now, Tom used biometrics, and I used traditional voice identification. We both came back and publicly said the voice of the person screaming is not George Zimmerman. And then they would say, well, who is? The media would ask us, or whoever would ask us, well, then who is the voice? And I always replied, since we've got witnesses that saw two people fighting, one was Trayvon Martin, who's now dead. We can't get an exemplar from him. The other is George Zimmerman, who's alive and on trial. We can get an exemplar from him. We need to record his voice screaming in that same location. Well, I went public with that. Tom went public with his findings, and we arrived at the same conclusion. We both believed the person screaming was not Trayvon Martin. I'm sorry, was not George Zimmerman, but rather, since there was only one other person there, we believed it was Trayvon Martin. Well, the judge in that trial decided not to let us testify because one of the big wigs in voice identification who still works for the FBI has been working for the FBI and doing voice identification for years. And he said to the judge during a preliminary trial prior to the trial starting that it was impossible, because he works for the FBI, it's impossible to determine just by a scream a voice identification. And the judge looked at his credibility, his integrity, his experience, and most importantly, the fact that he works for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And the judge said, okay, that's it. No experts on voice identification. The reason the trial was won and George Zimmerman went back on the street and was not found guilty for murder is because they had somebody testify who was a different expert. He was a coroner, a medical coroner expert,
Well, they had him up on the stand under oath for another reason. And the defendant's attorney started asking him questions about the screaming. Well, it turned out that he had been in Vietnam and he heard his buddies getting killed on the battlefield, and he knew who they were by their screams. So that, you know, even if the prosecution objected to that line of questioning, the judge allowed him to finish. And he said he's certain that the voice of the scream was George Zimmerman. So he disagreed with Tom and I. That would have been the perfect time for the prosecution to bring us in to testify against that conclusion, because he's not a voice identification expert. But his testimony was allowed on into record because he was up there for another reason. And the judge believed, because he served our country, was in Vietnam, and he was a coroner. I'm going to use that word. I don't know that he was a coroner, but somebody who went and brought the bodies back to give them a decent burial. That was one of his jobs in Vietnam. So he was used to hearing that screaming, and they decided that that was credible testimony. And I believe that's what turned that case around and got George Zimmerman acquitted. So when you ask about court and voice identification and scientists being in agreement, that's a perfect example of two of the best. And I'm not saying I'm the best, but I'd like to think I'm one of the best in the country. And Tom Owen, who teaches voice identification and provides degrees through an accredited university. And we both agreed, but yet Nagasaki, who works for the FBI, said you can't make a decision just based on the screen. Well, this was an important detail for this case, and his credibility trumped our credibility, and the court went with his testimony.
Ed, this has been great, and I've got to wrap up, unfortunately, but with the way how we're using video conferencing and creating podcasts and sending out voice messages, we'll have, you know, a repository of our voices somewhere out there in the cloud, and I imagine that at some point we can all be measured by that. Does that make sense? Or what does the future of voice recognition look like?
You're exactly correct. And if I were to fast forward and look into my crystal ball 20 years from now, I believe we're going to call our credit card company or our bank and ask for services, and we'll be identified by our voice instead of what's your birth date, what's your social security number, what's your address, what's your mother's maiden name, what year were you born, which is now how they're qualifying us, mortgage company, bank, lender, anybody who has anything to do with finances, credit card company, American Express. I believe we're going to get to a point in time where software and computers will identify the voices for us, and it will be accepted in court. I don't think we're quite there yet, which is why I haven't gone over to the biometric side, although I have worked with it and tested it. The Paul McCartney example I gave you, the voice biometric came back with less than 40% probability of a match with what I gave it. Now, there's a chance that I may not have put in enough or the correct verbiage, but I followed the instructions. I was given a fast instruction of training on it as opposed to a week-long training, so I'm pretty sure I did it right. But that's what I'm seeing in the future. And I'm also seeing these cases that I'm working on, which are pretty rock solid with the science that I'm bringing to it, that my results and my test findings are accurate. I'm confident that those are going to help the litigators understand what happened. So I think it's going to continue to earn respect, voice identification, and I believe it's going to continue to grow as a useful tool in many sectors, not just criminal and litigation. I believe it's going to be used in a lot of different places.
My thanks to our guest, the audio-video forensic expert Ed Primo. He's got a book out called That's Not My Voice, A Practical Understanding of the Art and Science of Modern Voice Identification. It's, of course, available on Amazon.com. If you missed any part of this program, you can download the podcast at our website, bfm.my. You've been listening to VoiceBox. I've been Ezra Zaid. Thanks for tuning in to the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.